After a few feet, they were in absolute impenetrable blackness. JB turned on his flashlight.
What is this place?
The flashlight beam glinted off mineral deposits embedded in the rough walls. Silvery granite, brilliant quartz, and green speckled limestone. By the light, they saw the walls were decorated with faded, crude paintings and carvings, representations of bizarre figures and shapes. JB paused to examine one of the paintings, which depicted some kind of horse-like, squat-bodied animal with two horns on its nose. The wolf trotted deliberately forward, the tunnel gaining a slight incline. The three men followed, occasionally confused by their own writhing shadows. The passageway forked, and the wolf unhesitatingly took the left-hand path. They hadn't gone far when Joe lurched to a halt. Resting atop a shelf of rock at eye level was a yellow-brown skull. Looking over his shoulder, Ryan saw that it wasn't a human skull, but that of an animal, one he had never seen. Feline in shape, it was twice the size of a normal panther's, and two great fangs, 6 inches in length, curved down from the upper jaw. Word pictures were painted across the brow. The sight of the skull raised Ryan's nape hairs and stirred to life old stories and even personal experiences with cave-dwelling monsters. The tense, silent progress through the tunnel continued. Ryan tried to keep other thoughts, other worries and fears from intruding into his single-minded march, but a few penetrated his guard. He couldn't shake the feeling that he, JB, and Joe were blithely striding through a death trap. He sneered at his growing dread, but when he hazarded a swift backward glance, he glimpsed, or thought he did, a shadow shifting in the gloom.
I think we're being followed.
Blood Sniffer suddenly whirled and bounded back in the direction they had come. Joe was knocked to the ground, and Ryan and JB both staggered back from the sudden force. JB's flashlight was thrown from his hand. The darkness suddenly surrounded them.
I knew it!
Mother Wakan!
That's Shishoka. She told us to lay down our blasters.
Oh, to hell with that.
They're back around the fork where our shots can't reach them.
We can't go back. We must go forward.
Go forward to where?
To wherever we end up.
The three men trotted through the black tunnel. They caromed off outcroppings and bumped their heads on stalactites. Testing the air currents with a wetted forefinger, Ryan felt a fairly strong movement to their right. By groping and feeling, he found a narrow side passage branching off from the tunnel. Since they were in a dead end, they had no choice but to crawl into the rough-edged passageway. All three men squeezed into it. It crept upward at a 45-degree angle, and the passage narrowed very quickly, the walls catching at Ryan's broad shoulders. Ryan was forced to turn sideways and scrabble onward and upward. Sweat slid from his forehead and stung his eye. As he was blinking it back, he realized that the darkness was no longer so absolute. He was able to pick out dim, dark gray shapes. Ahead and a little above them was a faint circle of starlight.
There's our exit.
They clawed their way up the cramped tunnel toward the little opening. They climbed out in starlight. They were standing on a small hill, and about a half a mile away were the cyclopean boulders around the cavern entrance. Below and to their right was the outer ring of teepees.
One of us should wait here, pick them off as they come out.
I think they expected us to come out in this place. They're probably running to outflank us.
Maybe so, but I want to get that double-crossing wolf.
Shh! Listen.
In the dim light of the night, from all directions, they saw four-legged shapes racing swiftly toward them.
Well, here's your chance, JB. Fire!
The hill became a bedlam of fire and movement.
Ryan! Duck!
Thanks.
There was a momentary lull in the attack. Ryan pulled the crystal-studded gold wafer from a pocket and slapped it against his forehead. He didn't have time to couch a telepathic call in words. His mind focused on a wordless message that was a plea, a pledge of love, and a promise at the same time. If performed vocally, it would have been a yowl of anguish. The wolves came again in a circling rush, and Ryan dropped the wafer.
Fire blast!
Son of a bitch! I'm out of ammo!
JB let the Uzi dangle from the lanyard around his neck and went to unsling the M4000 scatter gun from his shoulder.
JB!
Ryan wheeled aiming at the dark gray shape looming over the body of his friend. Ryan was hit from behind, the wind crushed from his body. He levered himself onto his back and looked directly into the blazing gold-green eyes of a furious beast. Ryan tried to swing his gun up and around, but a wide claw-tipped paw eclipsed everything else in his line of sight.
Ah! Christy!
It's Ryan.
Jack, Doc, Mildred, and Sunlata stared at Christy in bewilderment. During the past hour or so, they had been playing Arkahe, the Sioux game of bone casting. Sunlata, the girl who had acted as their food server, had elected herself their one-person entertainment committee as well.
What just happened?
I felt something terrible. A jumble of emotions.
Christy snatched up the wafer and pressed it against her forehead. She didn't concentrate. She lowered her mental barriers, waiting for a pattern to emerge. Mother Sonia had taught her the technique of activating her brow chakra, the seat of the sixth sense, the third eye of mystic legend. Through the opening of this chakra, this biological PowerPoint, she possessed the capacity to read emotional communications. Nothing came to her but flashes of color, psychic spillover from her friend's anxiety and worry. She saw and felt only a void, a lightless tunnel stretching past eternity and through infinity. Christy lowered the wafer. It was slick from the perspiration beating her forehead. She opened her eyes and realized she was lying on one of the beds. Mildred sat beside her, holding her left wrist and timing her pulse, her face etched in lines of worry.
Christy, God damn it, girl, I thought you were dying. Your pulse and respiration rate slowed to a crawl.
How long?
At least 20 minutes. Your entire body locked up like you were having an epileptic seizure. Sunlata and the others went to fetch the shaman.
No need.
A wave of pain surged through Christy's head, then faded. She knew what had happened, what her subconscious had done. She had only rarely entered a far-seeing trance, primarily because her mother hadn't fully trained her in protecting herself while in such a state. When her mind had expanded its awareness, her hindbrain took over, slowing her metabolism and reducing her need for oxygen. Leaving the trance state was more difficult than entering into it. Jack, Doc, Sunlata, and a skinny man wearing headgear made of feathers and buffalo horns rushed through the door. Bells and beads were attached to the skinny man's ankles. Before Christy could stand, the shaman began to skip in front of her, shaking handfuls of feathers and dirt over her head.
Ryan is in trouble. More than likely, so is JB.
I was afraid you'd say that.
What?
I said I was afraid you'd say that.
He tried to contact me through the sender. Since I didn't have mine working, I couldn't pick up any details. I tried transmitting to him, nothing.
That doesn't necessarily mean anything dire.
What? Ugh. Hey, jingle bells, get out!
The shaman affected not to have heard. Christy grabbed him by one arm, and with rather more force than she intended, dragged him toward the door.
Leave, now!
The man gave her a lingering look of reproach, then pursed his lips.
Ugh.
Christy's face was suddenly covered in chewed up flower petals. The shaman stormed out.
He provides bedside service, and this is the thanks he gets.
We've got to go after Ryan and JB.
Don't know where they are. Wolf, lead them.
Jack's right. We'd be tearing off into the dark both literally and figuratively.
Under the circumstances, we should wait for word or for one of them to return, or at least until daybreak. Besides, I suspect our hosts wouldn't allow us to depart without an armed guard. They're relying on us, remember?
On our weapons, you mean? But you're right. Let's wait until dawn. Then we'll go after them.
And if our hosts would rather we did not?
Then they get free demonstration of our weapons.
Though she earnestly tried, Sunlata couldn't revive their interest in the game. Around 2 o'clock, she left quietly. All of them knew they should catch some sleep, especially if they intended to undertake a rescue or investigative mission in a few hours. Adrenaline kept them alert. According to Christy's cron, it was 4:30 when Jack's head swiveled toward the door.
Ryder's coming in.
As one, all four people got to their feet and rushed out, none of them wanting to surrender to either the hope or dread battling for dominance in their hearts and minds. Outside, they circled the great tree, heading for the horse compound. They had taken only a few steps when Joe emerged from the darkness. The right sleeve of his buckskin tunic was ripped, and his hand showed a speckling of blood. The barrel of his gun drooped toward the ground. In his left hand, he held a small, blocky object. When he saw the four friends, he stopped in his tracks. None of them spoke. With eyes clouded with fatigue and the bitterness of defeat, he swept his gaze across their faces, pausing at Christie's, then finally settling upon Mildred's. Joe extended his left hand. Gripped within it was JB's fedora. The crown was battered, the brim notched, and stained with a pattern of dried blood.
I am sorry.
JB awoke, alone in the depths of the dark forest. He had lost a fair amount of blood from the fang-inflicted gash across the base of his throat. The back of his head was swollen, and it throbbed in cadence with his pulse. He figured he was suffering from a mild concussion. He knew he had gotten off lucky, though. When the wolf had slashed his throat with razored teeth, missing his jugular by a fractional margin, he had fallen and struck his head against a stone. The animal had apparently believed him dead and left him. The armorer had awakened alone in the shadows, and his wristchron told him that only a few minutes had elapsed. He had found himself weaponless, his Uzi, his scattergun, and all the spare ammo missing. He had no idea of the fates of Ryan or Joe, but he knew he couldn't stay where he was. Stumbling, dripping blood, feeling his way, he had backtracked through the tunnel, hoping to return to Little Mountain and the horses. He had staggered out of the tunnel and stumbled up the wooded slopes. The effort had exhausted him, and he had crept into a hollow between two large gnarled roots and lay down. Now his thinking was sharper, and JB saw by his cron that only 3 hours remained until dawn. He doubted that Little Mountain was still waiting. A rugged trek on foot stretched before him, a march he wouldn't have enjoyed even if he wasn't weak and racked with pain. He examined the wound on his throat by touch. The bleeding had stopped, but his shirt front was caked and sticky with blood. Though his throat hurt, he realized it wasn't much more than superficial, more unsightly than critical. The swelling on the back of his head was more worrisome. Mildred would diagnose it as a closed skull injury, and he knew from his years on Trader's War Wags that head traumas were tricky. He could have sustained a skull fracture and be suffering from a cranial leakage of blood for all he knew.
Oh, damn it. The hell with that. I'm going back for the others, then return to rescue Ryan or recover his body. My brains can ooze out my ears, but I'm coming back.
Mildred lay on their bunk, her face in a pillow. JB's fedora was crumpled between her hands. Mildred's upper body jackknifed up at the waist, her face contorted in fear, reaching beneath the tear-stained pillow. The ZKR was in Mildred's hand in an instant.
So, you have my hat.
JB half-crouched on the floor beside the bed, his limbs shaking as if caught in a spasm.
John? John!
Oh, easy!
Oh, John! Oh, John, I'm sorry. I thought you were... Well, I thought... Christy! Jack! Doc!
The three companions hurried into the room. Their faces in the weak sunlight were masks of grief. Then when they saw JB standing beside Mildred, their jaws dropped.
JB, you're okay?
Yeah, for the most part. Ow.
There'll be time for questions later. Give him room. He's hurt.
Sitting at the table, JB allowed Mildred to clean and probe the ugly cut on his neck.
So what happened?
We were attacked at the wolf soldier encampment. We got there and that damned wolf somehow found a way to double cross us. We held them off for a bit, but there were too many. I woke up a little while later like this.
What about Ryan?
I don't know. I'm sorry, Christy.
This might need stitches.
Perhaps I should fetch our Jingle Bell Shaman?
Joe said you were both dead.
Well, he's obviously wrong. He must have left us both for dead.
And here I am.
A miscalculation. I apologize, Mr. Dix.
Joe came into the room, followed closely by Little Mountain.
Weren't the only thing you miscalculated, you triple-stoop fuck-up?
The fortunes of war. I admit I was a fool not to realize that when Bloodsniffer sent his pack brother back along our trail, he'd strike our scent and thus know something was wrong. He brought the wolf soldiers down on us.
I'm heading out to the wolf soldiers under a flag of truce. I'll find Ryan, or his body.
Or your death. Too much blood has now been spilled to call a truce between our factions.
We're not members of any factions. We're bowing out of this intertribal conflict right now.
You came here for gold, and you can get it. Tomorrow, we'll start our drive to the wolf soldiers' camp and the cavern. After we're victorious, you can do whatever you like.
Are you deaf? We're through with it. We're through with you.
And you're through, too. You can never take the camp or even the cavern without us. The wolf packs will pull your asses down and tear them to bite-sized pieces.
You're right. But we can do it without you.
What do you mean? You brought us here to do what you could not.
No, I don't need you. All I need are your weapons.
With that, Joe reached behind him and brought up JB's Uzi. Little Mountain stepped forward. The Smith & Wesson M4000 scattergun held at waist level. Christy and Jack reached for their holstered guns. Mildred, still ministering to JB, was caught flat-footed, having left her revolver on the bunk. Doc's Lamar was snug inside the sheath strapped to his leg, but the gun wasn't designed for a quick draw. Realizing the odds, the companions froze, hands on their gun butts.
No, go ahead and draw them. Put them on the table and step back. Your cane, too, Dr. Tanner.
Slowly, their faces grim and sick, everyone obeyed and moved against the far wall.
You five are in a fix. You have no choice but to live up to your end of the bargain.
We're not helping you. The bargain was we would aid you for gold. We no longer want it.
You're forgetting something. I'm your only way of leaving this valley alive. Like Mr. Dick said, the wolf packs guarding the pass will tear you to pieces.
What do you propose to do about it?
Simple. The prevailing wind blows north toward the cavern, and in this dry season, the woods and prairie grass are like tinder. All we need are a few torches.
Fire? If it gets out of control, the damage to the valley's ecology will be...
It won't get out of control, and even if it did, it wouldn't harm the cavern. Naturally, there will be suffering, but that's the price of any victory. Besides, once I have mastery of the forces within the cavern, I'll easily restore Tirawa.
Sound like you got this pretty well thought out.
I'm glad you approve.
Didn't say that.
Jack gave his right wrist a little shake, and his hand whipped up. A thin, flat, razor-edged knife gripped between thumb and forefinger.
New contest, Joe. See how fast you can drop that blaster before I put this in your eye.
Ryan saw the whole valley of Tirawa spread out below him. So far below that the great trees of the forest city appeared as a mere ripple of texture, like a shawl thrown over the laps of the mountains. He saw the high crags of the barrier peaks thrusting up into the sky, tossing the cold winds from their shoulders in flying clouds of snow. Colorful patterns and figures writhed, weaving into complex geometric shapes. There were colors he had never before seen, let alone imagined. The light, the figures, the shapes and colors melded and spiraled themselves into a vision, a panorama of black man shapes shambling out of a dark gray gloom. The man shapes were human, but not truly human. Only reflections in a broken mirror. Great, huge-shouldered, deep-chested brutes of men, with powerfully knotted thews and heavy brows thrusting over tiny eyes. The brutes melted, became skin-clad red men battling huge, shaggy elephants, dying to gain their precious bounty of meat. As Ryan dreamed, he could not watch the progression of visions quickly enough. The images seemed to tumble over one another in their haste to enter and exit his mind. He felt they had to slow down, to stop moving, to stand still. They didn't. He saw council fires of the great tribes bursting into flame for the first time. The red men kneeling in awe of Abadatea's mighty works and in gratitude of the grandmother's many gifts. He saw a man, much like the Sioux or the Cheyenne, staring in wonder at a shimmering, dancing, shifting column of light. Ryan stared at the light, trying to determine its color, but it blurred, and he couldn't will it back into focus. Slowly, reverently, the red man touched the light, bowing his head before it. The images swam faster now, flashing only a fraction of a split second in Ryan's mind. He saw armlets of frozen gold and shimmering silver, and discs of glinting crystal. Homes made of living trees, armored, helmeted men trampling uphill toward a mountain pass, arrows and spears flying, matchlocks belching flame. And over it all danced the unliving, undying light, shining and glowing forever inside the womb of the Grandmother, inside the Cavern of Creation. Then the light faded, and all Ryan knew was black. A black so deep, he knew he was dying. But he also knew he had a choice, not of when to die, but of whether to die. He wasn't sure if he should live or die, or dream. He felt a throbbing pain, and a moment later, he became aware of his body. And he knew he had decided to live, not to die, or to dream.
Ah, you're awake. Here, drink this.
Ryan opened his eye. Brilliant sunshine shafting down from above blasted into it. He squeezed the lid shut. He tried to touch his face and discovered he couldn't move either hand or his feet. Carefully, he opened his eye again, and this time he wasn't blinded. He focused slowly on the details of his surroundings. He was in a room shaped like a cone. The sunlight poured in from an opening above him, where the cone narrowed to a point. Dust motes danced magically all around him. He turned his head, first to the right, then the left, and finally down. He was hardly surprised that he was bound tightly. He was more surprised that he was alive. Ryan's wrists, legs, and ankles were tied securely by knotted leather thongs to a wood-framed, skin-covered latticework, like a hide-drying rack. He was in half-reclining position, and his hands were bound to the frame at ear level. He also saw he was naked.
The bonds are a precaution only, not an attempt to humiliate you.
Shishoka moved toward him, cutting through the sparkling dust motes. She was clothed in soft, white-fringed doeskin and high moccasins. Her raven-black hair cascaded down her back like an ebony waterfall. Bloodsniffer moved forward at her side, and Ryan couldn't keep the anger that flowed through him from registering on his face.
You actually owe him a great debt. He saved your life from his pack brothers. Saved all your lives, actually.
He betrayed us. Deceived us.
It is no sin to betray a betrayer or to deceive a deceiver. Touch the sky is both. Ryan Cawdor.
Is Joe Touch the Sky here? He escaped, didn't he? What about my friend?
No.
No what?
Neither of them escaped.
You mean they're...
We allowed them to leave.
What?
You were unconscious, and so was your friend. There was no way to capture Touch the Sky alive without more loss of life. We allowed him to leave. Allowed him to think he had escaped. Between the time we brought you here to our camp and returned for your friend, he was gone. We could find no trace of him, nor did we care to track him down.
Why didn't you chill me?
Are you afraid of death?
I don't want to die, but I can manage it if I have to.
An honest answer, Ryan Cawdor. However, it is not death you fear.
How would you know, hiding in this valley? Isolated from the rest of the world since the time of the caveman.
How do you know that? How do you know that, Ryan Cawdor?
I don't know. I must have dreamed it.
You dreamed it because I wished you to dream it.
I don't understand.
I gave you a taste of the dew of Abadatea, so you would understand.
Ryan ransacked his memory and recalled the liquid slime being forced down his throat. He had only woken up for the last dose.
You drugged me, made me high, made me hallucinate, tried to turn me into a jolthead so I believe any bullshit you spouted.
You are here to be judged, Outlander, not I.
Shishoka half turned away, stopped, and spun to face him.
The visions you saw were true ones, plucked from the ancestral memories of all who dwell in Tiratwa. For centuries beyond counting, our valley has been threatened by invaders from the outside world. The Spanish conquistadors, the white explorers, and more recently, the group you called the Red Cadre. We must protect the valley and the cavern as it has protected us, the lives and traditions of its children. Now it is threatened from within.
How? Touch the Sky wants to use the power of your cavern to heal the Earth, the Grandmother, she who has shown mercy to the children who have ripped and burned and poisoned her. You conditioned me to say that while I was doped up, didn't you?
Don't be a fool, Ryan Cotter. The spirit of the Grandmother has touched you, using Bloodsniffer and myself as channels. I admit we entered and influenced your dreams a time or two.
With one of those sender gadgets?
Yes. But if your innermost self, your spirit, had not been open to the contact, you would have never remembered the dreams, let alone been influenced by them.
All right. I can't say I believe or disbelieve you, but I can say that I don't disagree with Touch the Sky's dream of healing the Earth, setting right what the new cause did to it.
He has the mind of a visionary, but it is still a human mind, filled with petty dreams of greed and power. He has no idea how easily he could be overwhelmed by the invisible forces in the cavern, powers beyond his control or comprehension.
How can you be so sure?
There is a tradition in every religious culture that holds that anyone who looks upon the face of God will certainly die. For a mere human to entertain the arrogant notion of commanding the forces of creation is the same thing. Only in this instance, the entire world may die.
Ryan met her gaze, and his belly went cold. She wasn't being melodramatic. She was speaking the truth, at least as she understood it.
Why should I believe you? You might want to keep Touch the Sky from reaching the cavern simply because you're afraid of losing your position in the tribe.
And how do I know that you are not the Wawihangya Unkinoate Pizi claims you are?
I don't even know what that is.
The destroyer of the world.
Pretty big order for one man.
I realize that. Perhaps, you're just a Kaga.
I think I know that word. It means devil, right?
Close. Demon.
Shishoka walked toward Ryan and brought her face close to his. Her cool fingers came up and tentatively touched his chest.
Yes, I think you are more demon than destroyer, Ryan Cawdor.
Ryan tried to keep his body's reactions under control. He flicked his gaze to one side and saw Bloodsniffer staring up at him curiously. The heat of those blazing eyes quickly cooled his heated, automatic responses.
You are very brave, Outlander. But courage is a good quality, only when one is wise enough to know when to use it.
On the far side of the teepee, the flap was thrown back. A man stepped inside. He was old enough to have iron gray hair, but he stood as straight as the feather-bedecked ceremonial lance he gripped in one hand. He wore a loose buckskin tunic and fringed leggings. A necklace of wolf's fangs hung about his throat. Shishoka stepped away from Ryan. The man's eyes flicked from Ryan to her, then back to Ryan.
So, the Outlander has regained his senses. That is well. The pack leaders may now begin the judgment.
Judgment?
I said you were here to be judged. This is Peasy, my father's brother. Chief of the wolf soldiers. He demands justice for the lives you took.
Then, three great gray wolves stalked into the teepee, their eyes glaring at Ryan, hating him. He felt icy fingers tracing down his spine. The concept of facing an inhuman panel of judges awoke in him, a loathing he had never experienced.
When does the judgment begin?
It began the moment you entered this valley, Ryan Cawdor. But before you judge, Peasy, brothers, remember that this Outlander could be the last thread by which we may draw Tiratwa out of danger.
The Outlanders and their weapons are our greatest danger, Shishoka. This man and all those who came with him shall die. He seeks to help touch the sky, make Tirapwa like the outside world, a place of horror, bloodshed, and suffering. The blood of our dead calls for justice. The Outlanders have brought death and corruption into our sacred land. They have sinned against Abatatea and the Grandmother.
This man sinned in ignorance. He knew nothing of us until he came to this valley. He was deceived, duped into killing without realizing his crime.
He blundered here through greed, driven mad by the lust to possess the Grandmother's bounty. There can be only one penalty. What is the verdict of the pack? Then it is decided!
Ryan saw that Bloodsniffer was the only animal abstaining from the bloodthirsty vocalization. Peasy dipped the lance, and the point pressed lightly into the soft hollow at the base of Ryan's throat. Ryan kept his expression impassive and fixed his eye on Peasy's face.
Did the wolf soldier so fear the power of the Outlanders that you will murder me while I'm bound and helpless? If so, then end this farce and chill me now. I'm sick of all this wolf soldier bullshit.
Anger flashed briefly in Peasy's eyes, and the pressure of the spear point increased.
Enough! The Outlander, no matter what he has done, no matter what else he might be, is a warrior and deserving of a warrior's chance.
He had his chance.
Enough!
The pressure of the sharp point lessened on Ryan's throat, but Peasy didn't lower the lance.
You swore to recognize me as the one true guardian. The pack has rendered its verdict, but it is my duty, my right, to impose the final sentence.
And that is?
He must face a soldier in equal combat. If he survives, he will be a member of the pack. And if he betrays the pack, then the pack's justice prevails.
Peasy pulled back the lance.
Very well. One soldier must volunteer to face the Outlander. If one does not, then he dies.
Without hesitation, Bloodsniffer stepped forward and nosed Shishoka's hand. She looked down on the wolf with a fond, sad smile.
We have the volunteer.
Ryan stared at the big, muscular animal, trying to convince himself that, armed with his panga, he could make short work of Bloodsniffer. After all, he had battled other beasts, giant muty wolves included, and emerged alive, if not exactly unscathed. As if sensing his thoughts, Bloodsniffer looked over at him. Something in that intense and human gaze shook Ryan. Peasy stalked out of the teepee. The wolves remained, watching Ryan. Shishoka moved toward him, drawing a bone-handled knife with an obsidian blade from a voluminous sleeve. She began cutting the rawhide bindings around his arms and legs.
What kind of weapon can I use?
The same as Bloodsniffer. Your teeth and nails.
What?
Equal combat. There. Now you may stand erect.
Ryan touched his head, his fingers brushing a crusted lump on his right temple. He felt scabbed over claw marks. Peasy returned, his arms full of a furry bundle. For a moment, Ryan couldn't identify the dark, shaggy mass. Then he recognized it as the skin of a huge black wolf. The fore and hind legs still retained their shape, as did the head and the thick, bushy tail.
These are the remains of Death Maul, one of our most respected soldiers. Do not dishonor them.
The remains?
It is the custom of the wolf soldiers to retain the mortal coverings of their greatest warriors. The two-legged soldiers wear the skins of their departed four-legged brothers to give them strength and courage in battle.
It is the only protection you will have.
Ryan slowly put on the wolf skin, slipping his hands through leather straps sewn on the underside of the forepaws, attaching the main trunk to his chest and waist with a harness. Peasy pulled the skull cap over Ryan's head and secured it there with a thong knotted under his chin. The muzzle covered his forehead like a cowl. Outwardly, Ryan remained very calm, determined not to allow the flummery of superstitions and ritual to shake his nerve.
I'm half blind. Hardly an equal contest, unless you put out one of Bloodsniffer's eyes.
Bloodsniffer is lame in one leg. Due to you, I am told. It is as equal a contest as you deserve.
Follow.
Peasy marched out of the teepee, Ryan in step behind him. Shishoka and Bloodsniffer dogged his heels. The sun was fairly high, and Ryan estimated it was close to mid-morning. He had at least had a rest, of sorts. Only a few people were about in the encampment, men mostly, and Ryan could feel the hostility of their stares as he passed by. Peasy led the way through the ring of teepees and down a gently rolling incline to where the bases of four bluffs formed a natural bowl, like an amphitheater, or, as Ryan noted, an arena. Obeying Peasy's imperious gesture, Ryan went down into the bowl, Bloodsniffer following. Taking position in the center, Ryan made a 360-degree visual circuit. Men, women, and many wolves lined the base of the bluffs. All were staring at him unemotionally. Anger grew within Ryan. No matter what ancient tradition lay behind this trial by ordeal, it was still bread and circuses for the masses, nothing but entertainment of the type he and his friends had been forced to participate in when they were captives of Baron Mandeville. He had survived those gladiatorial games, and he would survive this one. Peasy raised his lance over his head. Ryan prepared himself for a long ceremonial speech, but the chief of the wolf soldiers said nothing at all. He jerked down the head of the lance, and the game was on. Even as he fell, Ryan seized Bloodsniffer by the throat and kicked him up and over. The wolf landed on its feet, though its balance was off due to its injured leg. Ryan rolled face down to show nothing more than the wolf skin. Bloodsniffer's huge jaws closed on the back of Ryan's fur-covered neck. The wolf shook him as a terrier would shake a rat. The animal's strength was enormous, and Ryan felt as if his head were being torn from his neck. The world tipped and tilted around him, and the ground rushed up to smash his face. Ryan fought his way to his hands and knees. Peering from beneath the wolf snout cantered over his forehead, he saw Bloodsniffer strutting in a lordly fashion a few feet away. He realized the beast was toying with him, intending to humiliate him before ripping out his heart. The anger that had been growing within Ryan suddenly burst in a wild flame of rage. But this rage was unlike the red fury that sometimes possessed him. He was dimly aware of a strange linking of his familiar human anger to an emotion far darker, more deep and primal. It was a man rage coalescing with beast rage, an atavistic fury fountaining up from the buried wells of savagery lurking within all human hearts. Ryan's muscles coiled tightly as he crouched and faced his enemy. He bared his teeth. Ryan closed a leg scissors lock around Bloodsniffer's lean body and gripped a handful of rough. He kept his own throat covered and sank his teeth into the side of his enemy's neck. Bloodsniffer's body, all muscle and sinew, twisted and bucked with such force that Ryan was thrown into the air. The animal moved like a wraith and sidestepped Ryan's charge. Blood flowed from Ryan's ribcage, but he didn't miss a beat. He grabbed Bloodsniffer's lame leg. Claws tore into Ryan's hand, forcing him to let go. Ryan saw the pounce coming and fell on his back, coming up with one foot into the creature's belly and kicking. The beast's hindquarters flew up with the impact of the kick, and it tumbled rump over snout to land gracelessly on its back. Before Bloodsniffer could rise, Ryan was up and over and on top of the wolf. He secured a headlock, one arm around the furry throat, the other pressing forward from behind. The wolf struggled, muscles like steel cables covered with fur, hind legs kicking and flailing, but still Ryan held his grip. Then, with a convulsive effort, Bloodsniffer twisted inside Ryan's crushing grip. Fangs fastened around Ryan's forearm. He was forced to release his hold or have his arteries ripped open. Back somersaulting away, Ryan kicked the wolf so hard in the rear that its hindquarters rose off the ground. The pair of combatants paused, glaring at each other. The hot, sweet taint of fresh blood tinged the air, and the spectator wolves sniffed and wrinkled their snouts in snarling grins. Bloodsniffer stood on wide-braced legs, flanks heaving, head hanging low, ears laid flat. Blood and sweat wetted the gray fur. Ryan trembled with fatigue,
As the first rush of adrenaline faded, he began to feel the pain of his wounds, feel weakness as his blood streamed from them. Perspiration formed beneath the heavy wolfskin, trickling down his body and into the raw lacerations on his chest and ribs. Though they stung fiercely, surrender wasn't an option. Slowly, he scanned the spectators. Peasy and his human warriors had become blank-faced, waiting. Only Shishoka showed any emotion. An expression of pity, of sorrow, was in her somber eyes. But Ryan had no idea if it was for him or Bloodsniffer. Though the dulled fire of beast rage still burned within him, Ryan's reason told him that he couldn't hope to kill his opponent. It was doubtful if Bloodsniffer could kill him, either. They were too evenly matched. The best that could be hoped for, after a protracted and bloody battle, was a stalemate. Even if that was the outcome, Ryan would be so chewed and clawed he would have to spend days, maybe weeks, convalescing. His face set in a grim mask, Ryan slowly climbed to his feet, noting distantly that standing erect felt a little strange. He tugged the wolf cow back from his head.
Fuck you, Peasy! I won't perform for you any longer! Neither of us will! Cut it, Chubby, yourself! If you have the guts!
At Ryan's words, Peasy's brows lowered, and a monstrous wrath flared in his eyes. His lips writhed, and hefting his lance, he made a motion to jump down into the arena. Bloodsniffer suddenly bounded forward, taking a position between the two men. The wolf took three soft, padding steps toward Peasy, and sunlight gleamed on bared fangs. The meaning of that growl was unmistakable. Shishoka looked smugly at Peasy, then turned to Ryan.
It is over! Bloodsniffer has accepted Ryan Cotter into the pack. He is now a wolf soldier!
If any of you have the least bit of influence over your young friend, now is the time to exert it.
Joe's finger tightened on the trigger of the Uzi, his knuckle turning white. Jack's crimson eyes were locked in a sardonic challenge with Joe's black, unblinking gaze. The blade in his hand was rock steady.
One knife against two blasters, don't be stoop.
The smart man, you'd a stoop. Chew me, sure, but you die too.
Enough, Jack. Put away the blade. You can only chill Joe.
It's what I want.
And what about you?
I don't care.
I care. We all care. And you've got to care, too. When you drop Joe, Little Mountain will open up with a scatter gun. All of us will die.
The teenager's gaze wavered slightly.
It's not necessary. Joe said we're in a fix, and he's right. But we've gotten out of plenty of fixes and fixed the fixers. Remember?
The knife didn't so much as tremble in the white fingers.
You fixed the general, remember? Took you a time, but you fixed him.
Fixed him good.
Give all of us that same time to fix Joe.
Oh. Shit.
Jack tossed his blade down.
Excellent choice.
Cutter!
Several warriors came into the room, holding strips of rawhide. They soon went to work, tying the companion's wrists.
Well, Christy, young Jack is in your debt.
So are you.
Two warriors collected the weapons from the table.
So what's next, Joe? You gonna chill us before you ride down on the wolf soldier encampment?
No. You will ride with us. Your presence is required to spur on my more superstitious warriors. Their vanity will not allow them to stay behind while white demons fight in their stead.
If you inspire so little confidence among your troops, then how can you hope to succeed in your military endeavor?
Do you think me naive, Dr. Tanner? I have traveled far, farther than any man in this valley, and seen many lands, many people. I have lived among the whites and read many books. I know the fears of my warriors are smoke. With your weapons in their hands, they will know it too. Now, I'll fetch you when I need you.
You can have this wolfskin back now. Where are my clothes and weapons? Peasy picked up a tied deerhide bundle from the floor and tossed it to him. Opening the bundle, Ryan saw all his possessions, including his gun belt, Sig Sauer, a spare ammo clip, and his ponga. Only the golden wafer was missing. He continued to take off the skin of Death Maul.
I will treat your wounds. You need a bandage on that arm.
Ryan pulled on his pants and buckled his gun belt around his waist before allowing Shishoka to minister to him. He sat on a buffalo robe, and with a bowl of warm water, a cloth, and some sort of stinging, stinking ointment, Shishoka cleaned his scratches and lacerations. The bite on his forearm burned like a hot coal, but he knew it wasn't as severe as it could have been. Bloodsniffer sat on his haunches, licking the bite Ryan had inflicted. The wolf had fought with a restrained savagery, obviously not wanting to kill him unless there was no other choice.
In bygone days, you would have died long before you even saw the pass to the valley. You found your way here through a traitor's cunning, a traitor's treachery.
According to Touch the Sky, you're the traitors. You refuse to use the powers at your command to heal the earth.
No. Touch the Sky is a vain fool. He found us several seasons ago and immediately devoted himself to protecting this valley. He felt he was more worthy of the guardianship of the Cavern Keeper Society than Shishoka, and so attached himself to Towashi, my brother. When Towashi died, the hereditary title of guardian automatically passed on to Shishoka, a tradition that has been observed for generations.
He told me Towashi intended for him to assume the title, because he had no sons. He said that neither he nor Shishoka had been initiated into the secret knowledge of how to call upon the cavern's powers. He feels you practice low laws, not the high laws.
Oh, first of all, Tiratwa is not a patriarchy. The guardianship mantle is inherited by the firstborn child of the guardian, regardless of the sex.
Were you initiated into the secrets?
There are no secrets. Therefore, no initiation rites.
Touch the Sky believes there are initiation rites and secrets to learn.
We know what he believes. The vainglorious fantasy he built up around the valley and the cavern wouldn't allow him to believe anything else. Nor does he understand that Tiratwa acts as a balance between the high and low laws, achieving a balance between the heavens and the earth. He doesn't know enough about us to even begin to realize he doesn't know enough.
Didn't his ancestors live here?
According to some, everybody's ancestors lived here tens of thousands of years ago.
So he has no real tie to Tiratwa? No valid claim to the guardianship title?
He has nothing but a rabble-rouser's abilities. He convinced some of our people, young ones mostly, that a wonderful magical gift lay buried in the cavern, and Shishoka wanted it all to herself. He persuaded a few warriors, a few dreamers, that with the gift, he could transform the entire world into a mirror image of Tiratwa, and the planet would be restored to its state before the whites ruined it. As chief of the wolf soldiers and uncle to Shishoka, I supported her against his accusations. We didn't expect him to mount an attack against us and drive us from our own city.
When he left here, Bloodsniffer and I shadowed Touch the Sky on the plain. He then went to Amicus, and we followed him there, where Bloodsniffer saw you and your friends. He had an instinct about you.
Ryan glanced at the wolf. The animal was stretched on its side, evidently asleep.
An instinct?
That you and his kind were kindred. He tested that instinct when you dreamed.
He was my animal spirit guide. My totem. That's why he didn't kill me, even when you ordered him to.
And that's why you didn't kill him, even when you were ordered to.
I know what Touch the Sky believes about this place. What do you believe, PZ?
Our forefathers cultivated Tiratwa, but the forest city was ancient even in our oldest histories. Yes, much of the old knowledge has been lost, but we do not mourn it. Nor has this valley always been a land of peace and plenty. Anger, greed, and jealousy made Tiratwa run red with blood more than once. For many years, humans and animal sacrifices were made to the grandmother. But she was offended by the taking of lives, and it ended. For centuries, we have dwelt in peace. Tribes fleeing the white government found refuge here, and never spoke its location. Even when they were tortured by the whites, the Spanish, the French, Tiratwa endured the purification, and it will endure until the grandmother herself perishes.
And the intelligent wolves? How do you explain them?
Our brothers were always here.
And the senders? Where did they come from?
Again, they were always here. The technique of their use was taught by the first guardian, Nana Bozo.
Who made the senders?
The first people. They vanished many, many centuries ago.
What is the cavern? What makes it so important?
It is no secret. It's simple. The heart of the grandmother beats there. The life force of the world.
What does it look like?
I have never seen it. I know it is there. That is enough.
Touch the Sky thinks it's a core of energy, trapped in the cave since the very beginnings of the universe.
Yes.
He thinks your ancestors once had the knowledge to use that energy to manipulate the planet.
True.
All right, then. Why do you think he's a traitor for wanting to use the energy in the same way your ancestors did?
He thinks our ancestors used the power as a woman uses a needle and thread. Our ancestors were but vessels for the power. They obeyed its bidding.
Ryan leaned back, staring at the man incredulously. He glanced at Shishoka.
But what is it about...
About what...
Shh. Hold on. Christy?
The little bark lodge faced west, and since it was still morning, the sun shone against the far wall. The light peeping in around the edges of the animal pelt hanging in front of the low entrance was dim. The companions sat on the ground, leaning against the wooden walls, their bound wrists resting on their knees.
Not the waiting room in hell.
I've got to get out of here.
All of us have to get out of here.
No. I need to reach the crystal chamber. Maybe I can contact Ryan, if he's still alive.
If he is, and he doesn't have the sender, you won't be able to communicate with him.
I didn't say communicate. I said contact. With the crystals enhancing my own natural psionic abilities, I might at least be able to sense his mind.
And if you do, then what? And more importantly, if you do not, then what?
I don't know. But I need to know if Ryan's okay or not.
Raising her bound wrists to her mouth, Christy sank her teeth into the thongs. Everyone saw what she was doing and followed suit, though Doc gave up after a few experimental bites. The leather strips were tough, but they were sure they could chew through them given enough time, provided they had much of that commodity. The thongs tasted awful, but their flavor reminded Christy that they hadn't eaten in nearly 16 hours. She kept gnawing until her jaws ached and the rawhide was slippery with saliva. Suddenly, the pelt hanging in front of the door was pushed aside. Sunglata entered. She was holding an earthenware bowl full of water in one hand and another bowl containing some sort of steaming stew. Jack and Christy exchanged quick glances. As Sunglata stepped over to place the bowls in the center of the lodge, Jack's wire-taut muscles gave a heave and the thongs parted. Jack threw himself across the young woman's body, locking his hands around her slim throat to prevent any cries of alarm. He started to squeeze with all his strength when he realized Sunglata wasn't struggling or even trying to pry his fingers away. Jack stopped trying to choke her into senselessness. She was staring up at him with a strained smile on her face.
Stoop. Triple stoop.
No, I think she's in love with you, though that might make her more than a triple stoop.
Let her go.
We're of such a novelty value, especially you, Jack, that whatever loyalty she may have to Joe's cause is vitiated.
I'm betting she doesn't have much loyalty at all. He's fairly new here and has caused a split in the society. Maybe she'll help us.
Using bursts of sign language and flat-out wild gesticulation, they were able to get Sunglata to understand that Christy wanted to visit the crystal chamber.
You have an idea?
Sunglata tugged at her doeskin smock and mantle.
She's suggesting I wear her clothes.
Christy pointed to Sunglata's black tresses, then her own fiery mane, and shrugged questioningly. Sunglata pulled up her fringed mantle over her head like a hood and nodded.
Well, I suppose it's worth a chance.
She nodded back at Sunglata, and the young woman stripped out of her clothes so quickly that not even Doc had the time to avert his eyes.
Uninhibited little minx, isn't she?
As Sunglata sat naked and beaming at her from a corner, Christy put on her clothes. She didn't take any of her own off except for her boots so she could pull on the high moccasins. With Mildred's help, she pulled the mantle over her head and tucked all of her red hair beneath it.
How do I look?
Good, but you have to stoop a bit more.
Like this?
There you go.
I'll be back as soon as I can.
Sunglata sat very close to Jack, smiling as though she were part of a vastly amusing game. Christy stepped into the crystal chamber and made a beeline for one of the translucent mineral points. She put both hands around it and pressed her forehead against it, then closed her eyes to begin her preparations. The sender I had on me. Where is it?
Only a guardian may touch the Mazaska Wakang and the Inya Wakang.
Ryan felt his blood pressure ride. Bloodsniffer raised his head from the floor and blinked at him curiously. Forcing himself to keep calm, Ryan rose to his feet. Bravado, threats, and reaching for his gun would only shatter the tenuous bridge of trust he had built between Shishoka, Peasy, and the wolf.
I need the sender.
How do we know you won't contact Touch the Sky?
You'll have to trust me. I wouldn't ask you for it if it wasn't important.
Shishoka gave him a searching stare, then knelt and felt around beneath the robe upon which they had been sitting. She brought out the golden wafer and handed it to him.
Thank you.
Gingerly, Ryan pressed the crystal disc to his forehead.
Christy.
Lover. Oh, Gaia, where are you?
I'm here, Christy, in their village.
Oh, I'm just so glad you're alive.
Listen, you need to know about Joe. Is he with you?
No, he isn't. He took our guns and tied us up.
He what?
He just wanted our weapons. He's going to use our bodies just to get us closer to the cavern. And he has a plan for getting us there. He's going to set the valley on fire.
Fire?
Ryan was surprised by the depth of horror he experienced. His warrior's mind appreciated the beautifully simple plan, but he recoiled at its unutterable cruelty. A fire in the valley was far worse than their guns in the hands of Joe's warriors.
What do you want us to do?
Stay there. Don't start trouble unless you have to. Go back to your cell. I'll come for you.
Where will we go?
Back here. The encampment of the wolf soldiers.
Will we be safe there?
Yes. Wait for me, lover. Stay alive.
You too, lover. We're in a small hut near the edge of town. Can you see the image in your mind?
I can. Pretty neat trick.
I try.
Thanks. See you soon.
Ryan lowered the wafer and wiped at the sweat on his brow. He swept a fierce gaze over Shishoka, Peasy, and Bloodsniffer.
Touch the Sky has made prisoners of my friends. He's armed his warriors with our weapons to use against the wolf soldiers.
Shishoka and Peasy said nothing, but they stood quite still and fixed, waiting.
They'll be coming with fire for the forest.
Fire?
That is death for the valley!
Unless we stop them. I must free my friends and recover our weapons from our enemies.
I will alert the soldiers and the packs. We will attack the city.
No. A frontal assault pitting bows and arrows against automatic blasters will only get yourselves chilled. Your ancestors learned that lesson the hard way.
The blade has been drawn. There is no turning back. Blood calls for blood, and vengeance shall fall swiftly on this coward.
You sent assassins to kill Touch the Sky along the trail. That may be expedient, but it means you got no place to brand him a coward. That's the one thing he ain't. Shishoka, I'm going to the city. Who go with me?
Bloodsniffer rose and pressed his shoulder against Ryan's leg. Ryan reached down and stroked the wolf's broad head.
While we're gone, get your soldiers ready. No matter what else happens, hell is on its way.
The weapons drill wasn't going well. In fact, it was proceeding badly. Touch the Sky had chosen the best bowman in the city to wield the guns. Either their marksmanship could only be applied to arrows, or they were too disconcerted by the flame and noise that accompanied each squeeze of the trigger. Only a few of the man-sized targets that had been erected in a clearing showed lethal hits. Many of the targets showed no hits at all. Touch the Sky had railed at the men, demonstrated the proper way to fix target acquisition, and over he had shouted at them to squeeze the triggers, not to pull them. By mid-afternoon, the warriors had fired a lot of the Outlanders' ammunition and seemed no better. Touch the Sky walked to Little Mountain and spoke Lakota.
This is unbelievable. Are they fighting men or children?
You came here from outside and you do not yet fully understand our people. We have followed you against our traditions because you have proved yourself a strong warrior and have said you hold the power to make the world whole again.
The men with the weapons overheard Little Mountain's words and stepped closer.
My words are true. The power within the cavern is the legacy of our forefathers. It is kept from us.
A warrior holding the cold python shook his head.
The first people reared our city in the dawn of the beginnings of day. We have lived according to their ancient ways, and Tiratwa was spared the purification. Even if what you say is true, our actions violate those traditions. You brought outlanders here, and you want us to fight in the outland way against our own people. The valley is no longer the Tiratwa we knew.
We may bring forth the anger of the grandmother from the cavern. She may purify Tiratwa so it will be as it once was.
Why did the grandmother not come forth when the outlanders first entered the valley? If I have broken her laws, why has she not expressed her anger?
We have not entered the cavern of creation yet.
Touch the Sky started to speak, gazed at the stubborn, uneasy faces, and realized the futility of further argument. He raised his rifle to waist level, but he didn't point it at anyone.
I am war chief here. You all agreed to it. I have not suffered and bled for all of you to be sent trembling by groundless fears.
He faced them, his eyes bright, and the warriors shuffled away, cowed by the force of his fanaticism.
We have gone too far to turn back. We will follow through on our path, even if it leads to the grandmother herself.
The pony galloped across the grasslands toward the forest city. Ryan kept a close watch for Bloodsniffer, who had slipped on ahead, scouting for guard outposts or patrols. So far, the wolf had brought them safely to within a mile of the city. Bloodsniffer appeared 100 yards ahead, like a wisp of gray smoke blown on the wind. The wolf tilted its snout skyward and snapped at the air, signaling the way was clear. The sun had sunk behind the highest peaks by the time Ryan reached the outer perimeter of the city. He left the pony to graze in a stand of cottonwood trees. He wasn't concerned about the animal wandering away. If he couldn't steal mounts for his friends, one horse wouldn't do him much good anyway. Bloodsniffer joined him, and they crept forward, threading their way through the high grass, taking advantage of every fold, rise, and depression of the ground. As man and wolf slipped into the shelter of the first line of massive tree trunks, the sun disappeared completely. As silent as shadows, they followed the winding forest ways. The long avenues were deserted and silent. Ryan detected the acrid odor of cordite, as did Bloodsniffer, his muzzle wrinkling. The crystal discs glistened as cold as ice sculptures under the spreading boughs, and where the open doorways fronted the footpaths, they gaped empty and lightless. Lamplight flared in only a few of the trees, but there was no sound of talking or laughter. Ryan had been in such an atmosphere before. The city was preparing for war. Ryan and Bloodsniffer made their way to a small bark lodge, which was identical to the image Christie had transmitted to him. He spotted a sentry some distance away, leaning on his lance. His head was bowed, either half asleep, bored, or depressed. Bloodsniffer dropped into a crouch, belly almost on the ground, but Ryan touched him and shook his head. He had no doubt the wolf could take down the man, but he doubted Bloodsniffer could take him before he raised an outcry. Ryan drew his panga and stepped out of the shadow of an overhanging branch, walking quietly, heel to toe. He intended to clamp a hand over the sentry's mouth and slide the 18-inch blade of tooled steel between his third and fourth ribs. It was an act he had performed many times in the past, and he could have done it with patches over both eyes. When he was within 6 feet of the man, he realized that the sentry wasn't a man at all, but a boy, a stripling maybe 14 years old, only a few years older than Dean. Ryan swiftly reversed his grip on the knife.
Good boy.
Gathering a fistful of deerskin tunic in one hand and holding the lance in the other, Ryan dragged both toward the lodge.